Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science here on UK Health Radio. I'm Michelle Hammond, integrative health consultant, educator and practitioner, and someone deeply passionate about how we better understand and support human well-being in a modern world. Each week, we explore where timeless wisdom meets modern science, and more importantly, how we actually apply that in real life. Now, last week, I was joined by Brian D'Souza as we explored the power of music and sound, not just as something we can passively enjoy, but as something that can regulate, restore, and deeply reconnect us. So many of you reached out to share how much you enjoyed that episode. So thank you for sharing your insights. And for those that haven't yet listened, do jump on over to that episode after this. In fact, in many ways, today's conversation builds on that, because whether we're talking about sound, touch, environment, or connection, at the heart of it all is how we feel. And that brings me to today. Because if there's one place we can really look to understand how we're doing as a society, it's our young people. Across cultures, across time, they've always been kind of like a litmus test, haven't they? Not just of the health, but of the safety, of the sense of purpose and belonging and of hope. And right now, if we're honest, the signals are quite deafeningly loud. We're seeing rising levels of anxiety, depression, and emotional distress, increasing reports of self-harm, and more young people struggling to engage with school than ever before. And alongside that, there's this growing sense of pressure and comparison and disconnection. Now, it's easy to point to one thing, whether that's social media or the education system or even just the world at large. But the reality is, as both ancient wisdom and modern science tells us, is that health and well-being is never shaped by just one factor. It is shaped by the environment. It's shaped by our relationships, and it's shaped by a sense of safety, by whether we feel seen and supported and really part of something. And that's exactly what we're exploring today, because this isn't just about what's going wrong. It's about understanding what's needed. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ben Drabble, CEO of Train. Train Youth as an organisation work directly with young people in the community, supporting them in very real and very human ways. So this is a conversation about what's actually happening on the ground, what's changed, and what young people are really experiencing, but also what we can do and what generally helps. Because if young people are a reflection of the world around them, then this conversation matters to all of us. So let's get into it. Here's my conversation with Ben Drabble. So Ben, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with me here on the show. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you are the CEO of Train. And so before we get into Train and what it is, what it does and how it helps our young people, tell me about your backstory. Tell me about what led you to this point in time.
Yeah, sure. Well, I started my career in engineering, actually, but I quickly transitioned to the charity sector and I got a job working with young people in a kind of volunteer management capacity. But that took me to Didcot. And when I moved to Didcot, I heard about Train. I heard about this charity, which would just get youth workers and volunteers to walk around on the streets of Didcot, going up to groups of young people and getting to know them and chatting to them. And that sounded really interesting and just quite good fun. I know probably to a lot of your listeners, it sounds like a very scary prospect. It was a bit scary for me at first, but I just got into detached youth work, which is a very unique form of youth work, and just loved for years walking around on a Tuesday night, finding groups of young people who were hanging about on the streets because maybe home wasn't safe, or they were bored, or they had nothing to do, or there was stuff going on, and just kind of doing youth work in those very natural kind of organic environments. So I did that for many years as a volunteer for Train, and then, you know, Train reached the point where it was kind of ready as an organization to hire a CEO, and I'd been building a bit of a career in charity management anyway. So it was a wonderful opportunity then to step in and lead this organization.
Amazing. And that's been a kind of backbone of Train, hasn't it? That detached work. So for people that don't know what Train is and what it does or what youth work is, tell us more about the actual practicalities of that.
Yeah, so I'll start with youth work, and youth work is a profession which is all about building relationships with young people that aren't necessarily characterized with a particular agenda or with a particular kind of authority or power dynamic. So a lot of the trusted adults that young people will have in their lives, it might be teachers where there's a bit of a power dynamic and they have the aim of trying to teach them something. I guess youth workers come alongside young people without as much of a fixed agenda. It's really about letting the young people kind of lead that relationship. And it's about supporting them in more relaxed environments to fulfill their potential and address any challenges that they might be facing. And I'm sure many of us have benefited from those kind of adults in our lives. And that's what we do in youth work. So for Train, what that looks like is detached youth work, which I've talked about, you know, out on the streets, meeting young people in their own environments. We also do one-to-one mentoring work with young people. So some of that's in schools, some of that's in community, and a bit of group mentoring work as well. And that's kind of one-to-one relationships where we're coaching young people and helping them to work through challenges or fulfill goals that they might have. We then run open access youth clubs. So we've got a couple of wonderful youth centres, one here in Didcot and one in Wallingford, both in South Oxfordshire. And so we open the doors of that for young people just to come in and hang out. And then we do some leadership development, social action, and youth voice and youth advocacy programs as well. So this is really helping young people get to that point of, you know, more than just overcoming challenges, about thinking about the change they want to make in the world and how they can contribute positively to their communities.
It's such incredible work. And I know from just being here in South Oxfordshire alongside you, the difference it makes is phenomenal, and may more of it continue. But I mean, young people get a tough break, don't they, generally? And I think that's a generational thing, isn't it? I mean, every younger generation has been critiqued in some way by the generation that's gone before it. And so nothing new. I'm sure that traces back to the dawn of time. But at the moment, there seems to be a lot of very worrying statistics around young people's mental health. I mean, obviously, we're seeing massively escalating rises in everything from anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidal ideation. We're seeing a lot more disconnection in the learned environment and people feeling excluded from those environments. A lot more individuals on special learning needs and needing additional sort of care or advocacy. And it seems to have absolutely volcanoed in this last 10 years. Tell me about that from your perspective. Is that what you're seeing? And what do you think is really driving some of that?
Yeah, I mean, the picture that you're describing is consistent with what we're seeing. It's also consistent with a lot of the data that's out there at a national and even at times international level with regards to the changing things that, you know, the changing patterns and the challenges that young people in our communities are facing. In terms of what's driving it, there's no single and there's no easy answers here, but certainly I would point to really, you know, teenagers today, that first generation to really grow up post financial crisis and post austerity era. And so all that followed in terms of the cuts to public services, and I would say generally, you know, public services were in a pretty good place for me as I was growing up as a young person, and whereas now, and you can point to things like, you know, the closure of the children's centres, that's hit my local town particularly hard. And so, you know, really early years development has been an issue. I think young people have grown up with a much tougher educational environment to probably what I enjoyed, in terms of if you look at the cuts to education and how stretched schools have felt over the last 10, 15 years, that's been a driving factor. You've got parents just being a bit worse off and a bit more stressed, caused by cost of living crisis and all that sort of thing. And when parents don't have the means, and whether that's the kind of headspace or the time or the financial resources to provide for their kids, then that will have a knock-on effect on their development. And then we've got, you know, we've got the kind of technology impacts as well. And I'm sure we might get into that a little bit more, but, you know, the impact on this kind of first generation growing up with smartphones and with social media and the way that exacerbates some of these issues. And then, of course, we can finish by mentioning COVID as well and the impact of lockdown on at a really formative time for the kind of teenagers of today, and the gap in education that caused and the gap in socialization and the knock-on effects of their development. So I'd say those are probably the main drivers that I'd identify.
Yeah, and so let's look at those one by one then. So the cuts to public services, as you say, we have, I mean, you know, the population's growing massively, isn't it? And yet the resources and support to sort of manage and support that infrastructure definitely isn't. We're seeing that within the NHS as well, aren't we? You know, we're sort of, you know, living and breathing the reality of that. So with these cuts to public services, I've always said we are a country that is absolutely reliant on charity. And God forbid that ever should not be the case, because we wouldn't be able to do anywhere near even what we do do. How do we rectify that? I mean, obviously, as a charity yourself, you know, you've obviously had to keep going through that constant sort of hoops and processing of funding and applying for funding. How have you seen that change in this last sort of few years particularly? Hold that thought. We're just going to take a quick commercial break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, where I'm chatting to Ben Drabble, CEO of TRAIN, a youth organisation charity supporting our young people across the community. Let's jump back in.
I think if you chat to most kind of small charities out there, they'd all describe the funding landscape of being particularly difficult. You've always got this interesting kind of toing and froing, you know, when it comes to civil society about the role of the third sector and the role of the state in providing some of those core services to the most disadvantaged. I think what's happened in recent years is naturally the state has moved more towards crisis response and away from prevention. And that's totally understandable. Obviously, when funding squeezed, you prioritise the highest priority cases, and those tend to be more developed kind of crisis situations. But then you withdraw the money from prevention, and that creates crisis down the road. And so a lot of the preventative work has probably moved a little bit more to the third sector. You know, a good example of that in Wallingford, you've got the kind of fabulous family centre operating there. That was probably something that previously, you know, was more of a state-run service, and so the third sector steps in. But you know, I'm sure if you chat to them, as with other charities, the funding landscape is increasingly challenging. There's a high reliance on a finite number of funders with a finite number of kind of funds, and those aren't going to last forever, and they can't spread in the way that they need to. So yeah, the situation's challenging, and there's not obvious routes out of there. I mean, charities who have the resource to invest in income diversification and development can move more into the community fundraising and corporate donation space. But those are not straightforward, and they do require a level of, you know, amount of time and expertise to deploy.
Yeah. And so what is the, as you say, there's no easy route out, but for you as a charity, what would help? How would that belt be loosened and more opportunities flow for you as a charity if things could change?
I think one of the simplest things is what we're really trying to work hard on is to develop stronger relationships with our community, so that there's more of a sense of kind of local civil society to support endeavours like kind of community youth work. And so really what I mean there is kind of more volunteers coming through. People are prepared to give up their time to support, you know, to walk around on the streets with some of our youth workers and get to know young people, or to, you know, come along and help out with our football club or volunteer at our youth clubs. Those kind of things would make an enormous difference. And it's not, you know, it's an easy one to talk about because it's not, you know, when people say what would help, I don't want to respond with money because obviously we could all use more money, but we also have to be realistic about the state of the economy, and that's not going to change in the near future. And so the things that practically we can do, one is just improve those local community links, get more people kind of brought into the vision of supporting young people in their local community. Even, you know, teenagers aren't that scary, and they really value kind of trusted adult relationships. And then I think the other one is better collaboration across sectors. And one of the projects that we've been working on is to say, okay, recognizing there's just not enough money to go around and recognizing that we're all stretched, what can we do to collaborate better across education, across healthcare, across policing, across voluntary sector, across housing. So bring stakeholders from all those groups into a room and come up with a bit of a town-wide like youth plan, which everyone's bought into. And so we're not purely focused on our own agenda, but we recognize that you know, by laying down some of our organizational agenda and buying into a bit more of a shared vision, we can stop kind of passing the problems between us and, you know, doing those things just, oh, we'll refer that on, we'll get that off our desk, but actually taking a more systemic view and thinking, how do we collectively generate better outcomes for young people?
Beautiful. And I love that idea of just collaborating more and bringing the community together in its truest sense. And talking about volunteers, and I know that's been a rally cry for you for a while, and actually a greater diversity of volunteers as well. And a lot of people get put off with volunteering in their local community because they feel it has to be something that they commit to on a, you know, week by week basis, and maybe actually their schedules aren't that versatile. It doesn't always need to be that, does it? I mean, great if you can have people that can regularly show up at the same day, same time, but actually it's okay also for those people that are just able less frequently or more erratically to get involved and support.
Yeah, I think so. And I think when you look at volunteering trends in the UK, what you're describing is absolutely what the future looks like. The days of that kind of loyal week in, week out are really shifting. That volunteers have different expectations, and that's something that community groups need to adapt to. And look, it absolutely can be more flexible. You know, we've had, you know, I've got a volunteer who's just at the end of the phone when I've got a DIY problem, and if I need something fixing in the youth centre, they'll just say, yeah, I've got a day off on this day, I'll come and fix that for you. And so there's a flexibility like that. I need some graphic design doing, and I put a shout out for volunteers, and I had a volunteer from Kathmandu, Nepal, say, oh yeah, I'm a graphic designer, let me help you out with that project. And so, you know, someone who's very, very far away, just doing a fixed project, you know, in their own time. And that worked out brilliantly. So a minibus driver is another good example. You know, I don't need them often, but it'd be fabulous if, and that's just anyone of a certain age with a driving license can, you know, because the licensing rules change. So I'm not allowed to drive a minibus, but someone who's a bit older than me will have the ability on their license. So there's examples like that of how there's opportunities out there, and charities are very happy to be flexible.
Yeah, amazing. And again, it just shows that actually the community doesn't have to just be about our kind of locality. The global community can kind of rally around and sort of help as well. That's beautiful. I love that. You mentioned before, Ben, actually, you know, one of the challenges is schools being stretched. And actually, having had my own children, and when Josh was younger, who's kind of just fast approaching 16, but when he was younger, I was quite surprised in our local community where we were living at the time, when the schools were kind of rally crying for everything from toilet roll to kind of craft, you know, sort of kits. And it was like, what? There's no funding? And it was a real eye-opener to me, because I kind of just assumed the business of running school, you know, was kind of covered in sort of, you know, the taxpayers' sort of costs, and realizing that actually on the ground, no, the reality was teachers were funding aspects themselves, and actually they were massively under-resourced for some of the basics, let alone then being set up and having the right education resources and infrastructure to support a changing dynamic and a changing landscape. Mm. How do you see that having changed, and where are kind of some of the opportunities to sort of help and support there, or to see improvements made within that kind of school system?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always, often in youth work, it can be fashionable to kind of criticize the schools as the enemy and the ones causing the problems. And look, I think every system is perfectly designed for the outcomes it gets. I think that schools are so often run on the goodwill of teachers, and they would just collapse without that without that kind of goodwill. And, you know, I'm a little bit biased because I'm married to a teacher. But exactly as you say, teachers digging into their own pockets to kind of fund resources for the schools, that's quite common. Teachers constantly pulling hours way beyond their contracted hours and working through the holidays too, working weekends just to meet the needs of young people. So there's a kind of the compounding of the underfunding over many, many years is really pushing a lot of schools into a difficult position. I think that there are opportunities out there in terms of, and there's some wonderful examples of schools who have taken a very progressive, very difficult decisions to try and improve holistic wellbeing outcomes for young people. Locally to us, there's a school who's really championed and led the way a little bit, even at a national level, on some of the kind of smartphone free stuff and getting smartphones out of schools. Not an easy decision, but one they've taken a very principled approach on, which has proved to be quite effective, and they're leading the way in that space. So I'm encouraged by that. I think schools where they're really trying to invest in some of those therapeutic practices and, you know, prioritize well-being in different ways, and that could be through kind of external partnerships. So a good example of that is like in Wallingford, the school have kind of come to an agreement with Train to second one of our youth workers into the school. So we've got a youth worker embedded in there and really just trying to do that preventative work, pick up some of that one-to-one mentoring with the young people that we in the school are worried about, which long-term brings those better educational outcomes, which is ultimately what the schools end up being judged on and which they have to be accountable for, alongside things like attendance. And obviously youth work has a real positive benefit of attendance. There's good evidence for that out there. And then again, you know, where schools are able to, and I think that often our message to schools is to say, like, we know you're stretched for resources, but understand the resources of your community. You know, we're here, we are a resource, we're here to be used. And there's charities in most towns saying that same thing. And often there's just a bit of a barrier in terms of relationships to finding out those areas for collaboration. But, you know, a lot of these things will feel like sticking plasters until we can get to kind of the core root, and that's a big picture economic decision about how we want to, you know, invest in the education system, which has been underfunded for many, many years. One final comment is just, you know, we've got the kind of SEN white paper released, and over the next few years we'll see massive changes to the way SEN is handled in schools, with probably a bit of an emphasis on that being pushed more into schools to come up with solutions on sites, less use of alternate provisions in terms of moving young people out. And I think that generally will create a bit of a culture shift in terms of the school's understanding of their responsibilities towards SEN, and also some of the funding that can come with that, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a massive burden, hasn't it, for a lot of schools as well, is to kind of staff and have the infrastructure and the kind of the educational know-how actually to adapt and meet growing diversity of young people where they are. I want to just jump onto the social media thing, because you mentioned that and an exemplary school, and obviously it's hot in the press right now, isn't it? And of course there are countries that are making the initiatives to ban social media for young people, and lots of kind of comments and sort of thinking around the harm social media are doing. And I think there's no secret to the fact that social media has obviously a really dark side to it, as most things do. But actually, there's also been a lot of positives with that ability to create community and connection and for collaboration and for learning. So often it's not the resource itself, it's how it's being used or maybe how it's being manipulated or sort of harnessed by sort of some. From my point of view as a community-based mental health practitioner, it's more for me about just the amount of time young people seem to spend online rather than actually engaging in real life activity. And particularly more worrying for very young people when that's often used as a babysitting tool, often for the right reasons. Parents that are just trying to pay their bills and do their job. This is not a judgment call, but the kind of worry from very little ones to older ones, the amount of time we're engaged online, and sometimes then sucked into, you know, seeing things and engaging with things we maybe not you know, sort of ready for. We're not developmentally ready for, and we haven't got any support through. What are your thoughts around that? Because as you say, as Train particularly, you know, you're the voice of the young people. And so with that in mind, what is it you're hearing, and how much of an issue do you think technology has played, social media has played, and what would you like to see happen, or do you think would be a sensible, responsible next step? And as you ponder that thought, we're just going to take a quick commercial break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, where I'm chatting to Ben Drabble, CEO of Train, a youth organisation charity supporting our young people across the community. Let's jump back in.
Yeah, I think you've raised a lot of the important points already, Michelle, about the issues we're seeing. And we have this, you know, every time a new technology comes along, and whether it was the internet or video gaming, or, you know, I remember my day, rap music, everyone getting concerned about, you know, there's always these kind of cries about what impact will this have on the kids and all the rest of it. I think what's unique about social media is probably the scale of it and the engineering of addiction, which has been so carefully crafted by some of the very best scientists of our generation. And so what would I like to see? Look, I think we'll look back on this era and we'll just be, it will just be this blip in history, and we'll be horrified, and we'll all say, how on earth did we let this happen? How did we fail this generation so dramatically? It does feel like the tide's turning now. I think, as you say, there's evidence of legislation coming through. Public perception has really shifted. You know, when I remember when Facebook first came out, and there was amongst the general public an optimism and an excitement about the possibilities it held. You know, wow, we get to connect with people all over the world. Imagine how this could change society for the better. I don't hear any of that optimism about social media now at all. I think that's well and truly gone. Public opinion has turned, and with that, the politics will shift and the legislation will shift. It's just that we failed a generation in the midst of it all. You're right that I need to be a voice on behalf of young people who would say, you know, as they've been saying in Australia, don't punish us for the failures of the tech company. You know, this is not about punishing end users. This is about, you know, regulating the ecosystem. I think those are all really valid voices. And I think the regulation in whatever form it takes really needs to continue to promote freedoms of young people. The truth is that today young people actually enjoy very little freedom compared to what you and I enjoyed when we were young. Even if you look at issues like the age at which we first walked to school by ourselves, or the age at which parents used to send us down to the shops to buy something for them, or the age at which we were able to get our first job. All those freedoms are being consistently curtailed, as in freedoms in the physical world, in spite of all the evidence that the physical world is the safest it's ever been. And yet we've given them far too much freedom in the online world. And so I hope that we have a future which is promotes more freedom, autonomy for young people, but in a safer environment. And right now, the physical world's really safe and the online world's pretty dangerous for young people.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important point, isn't it? I mean, you know, as you know, the generations that have gone before, you know, we took for granted, didn't we, that freedom. I mean, my mum used to pick us out on a weekend at 8 a.m. and we weren't welcome back until about 5 until yes. Tea was on the table. And I say it with love in my heart, but I'm not sure she cared what we did or where we went. You know, she just trusted we would go and entertain ourselves and play age-appropriate yeah. sort of games and activities. And, you know, she was fortunate with the roll of that dice that actually we did on the main. But we had spaces to go and do that. And as you say, actually now the reality is this is the kind of safest, particularly the kind of world we're living in right here in the UK and particularly here in South Oxfordshire. It's a really safe place to be. Actually, a lot of young people are also now afraid of the outside world more than they are that that sort of online world because of some of the narratives that come around that. And, you know, maybe that's led by social media, some of it as well. I remember my own son going through a phase of like just needing a lot of reassurance before bedtime. And I thought, you know, he's a natural sort of worrier. He's naturally a little anxious. But then I realized a few months in, he'd watched something with his cousin and actually was worried about the white van man principle and potentially someone breaking in and kidnapping him and sort of whatnot. Wow. And so it'd kind of been stimulated by something he'd seen and watched on online, but it had massively changed his perception of how safe he was in his own, you call an external environment. And obviously a lot of people hear and see things around them that maybe influence that. But it's about having spaces for young people to go. So, I mean, great, because Train have these youth centres that are there and available for people to come and sort of hang out, but reliant on funding for keeping the lights on and someone there to welcome them and support them through that process. But, you know, lots of green spaces specifically tailored for young people to be able to access have shrunk or disappeared, and access to sports and local clubs and activities. Have you noticed that? Have you seen that kind of changing landscape for that external environment that kind of truly welcomes young people, sort of yourself?
Yeah, enormously. And it's really a lot of it driven by the way like housing development's being done now, which by and large, you know, when a developer gets a plot of land, their kind of bottom line is how do we get bang for buck out of this? How do we concentrate as many dwellings as of highest value while fulfilling more or less our minimum statutory obligations to investment in the community? Often those community investments are feel a bit tokenistic, where, you know, talk, oh, let's make a historic path or something like that, which you're like, well, it just feels like a box ticking exercise. And then if, you know, where the kind of green spaces are created, I think that there's really an emphasis on what's the green spaces that are going to attract the house buyers. And so we're talking really about families of, you know, with young kids. Okay, so we'll build a kids' playground, or, you know, for other demographics. But often that teenage voice is really the lost one, and they find they're not really welcome anywhere. And if you take young people who are on a new kind of out of town housing estate, haven't got an easy mechanism for making the 2-3 mile trip into town, you know, with bus links and all the rest of it. So they're looking at spaces in there, in these kind of isolated new developments. There's a kids' playground, but if they go along there, they're criticised for, oh, this is for kids, you shouldn't be here. And there is just this general sense with teenagers where they're just not welcome anywhere. You know, if they do go into town, the expectation is, look, if you're going to engage with businesses, you need to be spending money. You know, McDonald's don't want you hanging out in there unless you're kind of regularly spending money. So, and they don't have access to money because we're not prepared to employ 12 to 16 year olds in a way that we were a generation ago. So they're in a tough position with the built environment, with the natural landscape as well. And then we need to think about that when we're doing development. One of the things we've just done is working with local government and town planners, you know, getting them in and doing consultation workshops with some of the young people at Train. And so really kind of hearing their voice about what is it you want from these spaces? How can we make them safer? How can we make them feel more accessible to you? And I'm hoping for some positive outcomes from those.
Yeah, amazing. And it's so important, isn't it? And as you say, that kind of teenage sort of unwelcomeness, again, has been a generational thing. I remember feeling it myself, you know, as a teenager, and we had spaces we could go to, and yet it still felt we weren't really welcome anywhere. You know, we were more considered a nuisance. And actually raising my own children, I really noticed the difference between all these different activities and inclusions and clubs for primary. And then the minute kind of Josh moved into secondary from 11 years onwards, it just falls off a cliff. And it's suddenly like, well, hang on a minute, what clubs are available now? What activities are available now? Yeah. And it becomes, you know, to say, unless they come along with higher price tags, it does seem to be the age group that consistently gets neglected. But now it matters more than ever, doesn't it? Yeah. Because of everything else changing around it. What are interesting with some of those kind of consultations you've been having? And I think that's so important to allow young people to have their voice and to share their thinking. But what have they been coming up with from your perspective with Train? What is it, if we look at just our community here, what is it young people want more of in their community? What are they asking for?
Well, yeah, they want safe spaces to go, and they want things to do, and they want trusted adults that they can be around safely. So there's obvious kind of solutions there in terms of, like, right, well, let's get youth clubs going. And I know there's an ambition from a lot of these kind of, you know, we think about Oxfordshire, we've got our towns, we're running youth clubs, but some of the villages, it's much more sporadic, and trying to get a kind of solution out there. A lot of the parish councils are kind of asking, right, how can we get youth clubs going? So there's those kind of things. I think young people are always going to love skate parks and football pitches. Always going to be popular. I think, you know, access to different activities that are maybe low cost or have lower barriers to entry. So we run an event, you know, we started an event last year called Youth Fest, and it was this kind of start of the summer holidays. Let's just get loads of young people, give them loads and loads of free stuff to do, and do taster workshops of all the different activities that are out there for them. With the idea being that actually the barriers to entry for some of these clubs, if you've never done taekwondo before or something like that, how do you even kind of get involved? We thought if we could just showcase all that's available to young people. Because one of the biggest issues I've observed is most organisations are quite poor at understanding how to market to young people, and then they're not an easy group to attract through kind of traditional marketing means. And so, you know, if you've got activities available for young people that they might like to get involved in, people don't know how to reach them with it. So the idea of our youth festival was to say, do you know what, actually there's loads going on for young people in South Oxfordshire. If we could showcase it all and broker all these relationships, maybe we could signpost them on to some of the activities. And whether that's like uniformed groups, which still remain really, really strong part of culture in this country. We've got fabulous cadets and scouts and, you know, guides and brownies and everything else in our community as well as across the country. So let's broker some of those relationships.
And as you say, I think that's such a brilliant idea, isn't it? Because it can really kind of encourage playfulness. And it's one of the ideas of why we're scoping to do the Wallingford Wellbeing Festival as a bigger community for all age groups. Because exactly that, it's an opportunity for people to come along with no sort of cost barrier to observe, engage, experience, participate, and just a bit more playfully, rather than kind of feeling like I've got this problem, or I need to sort of address this, and where do I go? But actually just allow people to come together and realize that social connection, community is a massive part of feeling safer, and that we belong more and finding more purpose, but also just giving people an opportunity that those that want to participate can go forward, but those that just want to watch and see first can do that kind of safely and sort of openly, and they can just explore things they don't know, because actually none of us know what we don't know, do we? And so we see all those things together, and then it opens our hearts and minds to what is there and what is available, and maybe that's something all of our local councils need to do more of as well, is be that advocate for kind of showcasing more of what is available and how it's available, and communicating that in the right way, and working with the right groups to make sure that communication is landing for who it's sort of being targeted to. Talk to me about the parental bit, because actually I think that's really interesting, and you wrote a piece for the last Wallingford Wellbeing magazine about all behaviour is communication, and that touched on this as well. But we often talk about young people, and we know that they're often made to feel like they're the problem, and they are the issue and unwelcome, and what we can do around that. But actually a lot of parents are struggling either with their young people or to manage the expectation of modern day life and keeping up with their work demands, paying, you know, the kind of only ever increasing costs of putting food on the table and roofs over people's heads, and getting their kids engaged. And I speak to lots of parents who feel really guilty because they're not in a situation to be able to do some of the fixes that they know, whether that's pay for psychological help and support because of the massive wait lists for kind of accessible and included sort of NHS or CAMHS-based support for mental health. And I was hearing staggering statistics of anything between the average of 18 weeks wait, even for those that are, you know, sort of suicidal ideation or even attempted. Than emergency care, right the way up to 7 years, I believe, in some areas of Oxford for send-based diagnosis and support, which just seems bonkers and probably way bigger topic for now and for you, Ben. I won't burden you with it. But just what is your thinking around that parent involvement within this? Because as I say, we often put it on young people, social media and the education system. But what part do parents play and how can we better support parents in feeling more able to meet their young people where they are today?
Yeah, I think in the article I wrote, you know, I kind of told the story of a local Facebook group, and they can be quite difficult places at the best of times. But someone had posted a picture of a young person saying, oh, if this is your young person, you should be ashamed. They've just been causing this antisocial behavior, one thing or another. And the parent, you know, bless her, pitched in, mum, wrote, that is my child. I am totally ashamed. I'm also at an absolute loss. I don't know what to do. I feel helpless. I've tried everything. I can't get any support from anywhere. The healthcare system's not interested. The education system's not interested. Everyone's forgotten my son and my relationship's broken down. I don't know what to do. And it was a really, really honest and quite heartbreaking kind of account, which is not untypical for what we see. We deal with a lot of kind of young men involved in antisocial behavior and criminal activity through our work, and often that story is not parents who are neglectful or not caring, they're just at a bit of a loss and not getting the support they need. So I think the kind of classic, oh, blame the parents, is inevitably unhelpful. Pointing fingers rarely helps. I do think that the expectations that we've placed on parents in modern society has shifted, and it's probably not been an altogether fair shift. We've probably removed, for good reasons, some of the approaches to kind of disciplining and control and authority that maybe my or your parents might have used, in that we've kind of changed the expectation on parents to be less authoritative figures and more kind of mentor and friend figures, which is a more time consuming, more challenging, more emotionally demanding kind of role to play a lot of the times. And also, I don't think it was necessarily a kind of fair expectation. I also think parents are more isolated than they were kind of a couple of generations ago, in terms of feeling like they're raising kids without the support of their wider community, as the traditional kind of pillars of community life have started to erode, and we've entered into this phase of voluntary isolation and sometimes involuntary isolation as a society generally. And so you're trying to tackle this alone, and then as you've rightly pointed out, without the support of kind of public services in the same way. So that's the root of a lot of the challenges that parents are facing. I think the solutions follow along those lines. I think if parents can find ways of building their networks and community and get that emotional support and practical support at an informal, you know, friendship, societal level, and that could be through charities or community groups or just neighbours, you know, by whatever means, family ideally, if they have the benefit of them around and they're helpful figures, as well as just, I guess, kind of improving the support we can offer to them at an early intervention stage wherever possible. A lot of the youth work that we do, you know, we pick up young people. Inevitably, youth work sits in that preventative space. We pick up young people as we see issues bubbling. If a safeguarding issue comes up, we can make that safeguarding. We can get them on the radar of social services or whatever help it might be a little bit earlier on. Often the first step in that, you know, under the Oxfordshire frameworks, we have these team around the family meetings where different kind of parts of the system come together to say to a family, right, how can we support? How can we help? What can we put in place for you? And if we can deal at that level, you know, it prevents it tipping over into more of the crisis zone.
I mean, it just screams again that it takes a village, doesn't it? And it's just the more I hear, whether I've been talking, you know, recently with people about the escalating rise in loneliness, whether that's for young people, which obviously is through the roof, and older people, whether it's through sort of disconnection generally or mental health kind of decline, or whatever the situation is that are impacting people's health and well-being at every age, it just screams back to that sense of kind of it takes a village. And yet we're all striving along, trying to live this human experience so independently or in isolation. And the reality is it is just impossible, isn't it? It's absolutely impossible to do that. And so again, that kind of community connection, collaboration, all sort of come back to the fore and show just how invaluable that is. But I think you're right. There's a lot of parents out there that also feel hugely ashamed and guilty for the things that they know they're not doing or are doing or could be doing better. And as you know, as a parent yourself, you know, I'm sure you're the same. I know I definitely feel it. There's just that it's a relentless job, isn't it? And of course, as I always say to my children, every day it's new, because I've never parented, you know, a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old. So actually every stage of it is a new sort of process, and nobody gives you a handbook, and it's something that you have to kind of navigate along. And you know, if you haven't got that support infrastructure yourself, and they haven't got that within their settings, whether that's through the education system or the community and their sort of recreational stuff, then it's just no wonder it kind of breaks so spectacularly. But I think we all have a responsibility to come together to, without judgment, to look at how we can better support that. What's your advice, Ben? So if anyone's sort of listening now, whether they're a parent, a teacher, a neighbour, what's some of the things you think we could, as a community, be doing differently to help train, to help our young people, and to be that village that we all need for one another?
Well, a few things. You know, if you pass young people in the street, smile at them. They spend their life feeling like they're being looked down on or judged, or you know, people wanting them to disappear. But anything you can do to say a kind word, or don't have that posture of that natural suspicion or judgment of young people, that would be the first thing. I think if you want to take a step further, I'm sure there's teenagers in your life who might value a kind of adult, whether it's your own kids or whether it's kind of friends or those within your community groups. And if you can't find them, then there's a proliferation of micro youth work charities like Train all around the country. They're almost certainly struggling for volunteers. They're almost certainly struggling for money. So anything you can do to support them would be hugely appreciated. And then the education piece as well would be my other plea. You know, there's schools always need various levels of that kind of voluntary expertise, whether that's going into class and helping kids to read, or whether it's donations to the PTA so they can buy some essential tools of the trade so they can actually do their job, taking a governance role if you've got particular skills that would support that. You know, as you say, Michelle, that it takes a village is something that's been lost in our more isolated existence, which has only been exacerbated by COVID, and recapturing some of that communal responsibility we have to the next generation. And if you need any more incentive, just remember that you enjoying a health retirement with functioning public services and a stable economy is entirely dependent on a fully economic active generation behind you. So if you need any more incentive, just remember that the teenagers today are the ones that are going to be propping up the economy so that you can enjoy retirement and old age with reasonable public services. If that scares you, then now's the chance to do something about it and do what you can to support the next generation.
Amazing. I love that. And that's kind of really visceral, isn't it, for many people sort of listening as well. So I hope that kind of prompts everyone to look at what they can do. Ben, thank you. I mean, not just for showing up today and sharing your wisdom and being on the show, but for all you do in your capacity as CEO of Train. It's such an invaluable service and such an invaluable support in our community, and long may it continue, and long may it continue to get the right support, as you say, whether that's, you know, sort of a constant stream of cash and also time, energy and sort of support from the community to enable and empower you guys to do the brilliant work you do. So thank you for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, I've loved the conversation. Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Wow, now that was a really powerful conversation, and one that for me felt both grounding and gently challenging. I hope for you too. Because it's when you hear what's really happening on the ground, not just the headlines, not just the statistics, but the lived experience of young people from those that are on the ground living and breathing this, It brings it closer. It makes it real. And I think what really stood out in my conversation with Ben is that while the challenges are significant, the responses don't always need to be complicated, but they do need to be human. We need to be giving our young people time and presence and consistency and care and creating safe experiential spaces. We need to provide people who will listen without judgment and without always just trying to fix everything straight away. And perhaps that's where this becomes less about what's wrong with young people and more about how we show up for and around them. Because whether you're a parent, a teacher, a therapist, or simply part of a local community, you have way more influence than you might think. So have a conversation, give a moment of attention, help create a space that feels safe. These things matter. And if today's conversation has resonated with you, there are ways to go a little further. You can find out more about the work being done by Train, whether that's through volunteering, supporting their initiatives, or simply helping raise awareness of what they do by jumping on over to their website at trainyouth.org.uk. Because organisations like this are often the bridge between where a young person is and where they have the potential to be. And more broadly, just maybe taking a moment to look around your own community and asking, where could I be part of the solution? If you're a professional and would like to learn more about how you can support your community and deepen the advocacy for health and well-being, you can jump on over to teapot.org.uk, where I share more insights, education and resources. Or if you're looking for one-to-one support, you can access my private practice at michellehammond.co.uk. And if you found today's episode valuable, do feel free to share it with someone who might appreciate it, or simply follow along with the show so you can join me for future conversations that explore how we live, feel and function well in a modern world. Because well-being isn't something we do in isolation. It's something we create together. Thank you as always for listening. And I look forward to you joining me next time for another conversation where ancient wisdom meets modern science. I'm Michelle Hammond, right here on UK Health Radio.